Our righteous and eternal Father, we're grateful to Thee for the opportunity we have to meet here together, to have an open discussion and to share our ideas, to share our interpretations of the gospel, and to share our love for each other and for the gospel. We're grateful for the people who have come long distances to share with us. We pray that Thou wilt be with them, that Thou wilt inspire them, that our hearts and minds will be open, that we will all go from this symposium feeling that we have gained much in the way of knowledge and understanding of Thee and of the gospel. We thank Thee again for all that which Thou hast blessed us, and we do this in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
How's the sound? Okay. Fine? Well, I had somebody going like this as I was welcoming you, so... I think that you do, our speakers will have to speak about this close to the mic, though. So, okay. Our presentations tonight, Jan suggested, will begin with the theological and end with the personal. I'd like to, my introduction of tonight's speakers will be brief, not because their qualifications aren't impressive and lengthy. Indeed, they're quite the contrary. But because I fully recognize that you came here to hear them and not me. Our speakers tonight will be Professors Jan Shipps and Valene Tippetts Avery. Let me introduce Jan first. Jan, I need that one paper. I'm sorry, I left the paper a paper down that I needed. And then following Jan's presentation, I will introduce Val. As most of you know, Jan is Mormonism's cherished insider-outsider. She is the author of Mormonism, A New Religious Tradition. While still engaged in Mormon studies, this professor of religious studies and history at Indiana University, Purdue University, with her forthcoming book entitled Being Mormon, The Latter-day Saints Since World War II, Jan believes, however, still says that she does not want to go to her grave as nothing more than that Methodist who studied the Mormons. She has been developing some expertise on religion in urban America recently. As a part of a project on religion in the urban context, which is funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated, she has accepted a commission to write a book which will address the question of what happened to religion as it made its way into the areas that would become the cities of the United States. Her presentation tonight is entitled Adventures of a Gentile Who Discovers a New Way to Explain Mormonism to the Press and Gains a New Understanding of the Restoration. Jan Shipps.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here, and can you guys hear me if I don't stick my head down this way? Let me talk like this. Can you hear me? Okay. All right. I'm going to talk like this so I don't have to stick my head down, because I'm mainly going to talk with you. I'm not going to read. I see somebody out there that I hadn't said hello to yet. I'm not going to read. In fact, I said we're going from the theological to the personal, but to get to the theological, I'm going to start with the personal, that is about me and who I am and what's going on in my life, which has turned out to be something really very unusual, shall we say. Some people say strange, some people say crazy. Anyway, somehow or other, in a strange turn of events, I started studying the Mormons in the early 1960s. In 1961, I wrote my master's thesis on Mormon history. And in 1965, I finished my doctorate in Mormon history. And I kept on studying the Mormons for a good long time. In 1985, I published my first book on the Mormons and just kept on about the Mormons. And I've never been a Mormon, And I've always been a Methodist, and that has intrigued some people and sort of puzzled others. But, and you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's always somebody at 2 o'clock in the morning after a long conversation that says, "How can you know so much and not believe?" And that's the intriguing thing to some people and the worrisome thing to others. Well, anyway, I wanted to tell you about what happens when you study religion in this world of ours. If you study religion and you teach in a religious studies department, from time to time, you get called by the press. Now, about, maybe a year ago, a reporter for the Atlanta Constitution, who also has a PhD and does a lot of religious history and who wrote a wonderful book called The Unsecular Media, which was also published by Illinois Press. Illinois Press publishes all our stuff, and our editor is sitting right down here. Anyway, he wrote a little pamphlet that was handed out to everybody that belongs to the American Academy of Religion. And what this pamphlet did was to tell people who study religion how to answer questions to the press. And mainly it said, be brief, be clear, tell people not everything that you know and you've put in your books, but everything that a reporter might be able to understand. It was a very interesting, he was a reporter. He, even though he wrote a book called The Unsecular Media, he knows that reporters don't know a lot about religion. I am here to tell you. Well, at any rate, when we got this, it was mailed out to all the members of the American Academy of Religion, and when we got it, we started, swapping notes. How often does the press call you? And people were saying, well, nobody, no person from the press has ever called me. Or I got a call one time, I think I can remember, way back when, or somebody that, but anybody that studies sects or anybody that studied the people, you know, that might be able to tell you about Hale Bopp, boy, they were really in the news. As it turned out, that's the kind of thing that happened to me, in the sense that my book came out right before it was revealed that Mark Hoffman had plagiarized the Salamander letter and all those documents, and right before the very famous Mormon murders. My book came out, and so the press, wanting to know enough about Mormonism to try to figure out what was going on with Mark Hoffman and so forth, started calling me. I was not a Mormon, and the reason they started calling me is that they talked to people at the Public Affairs Department, and the Public Affairs Department explained things in Mormon terms that the reporters didn't understand. Well, now, this is a special problem. This was a murder story, you know, the Hoffman murders. Everybody know about the Hoffman murders? Okay, well, instead of sending their religion reporters to Salt Lake to write the story, which is what they should have done, they sent their murder reporters out to Salt Lake and asked them to go out and write this story as a murder story, which it was, but it was also a very important religion story. And not only did you have reporters that didn't basically understand religion, but these reporters didn't even pretend to understand religion, and they would call me up, and they would get on the phone, and they'd say, "Now, can you explain Mormonism to me?" Now, in Mark Silk's wonderful little pamphlet, he said, "Never use a sentence that's longer than 12 words. Explain Mormonism to me. Don't use a sentence longer than 12 words." explain Mormonism to me. Well, in one way or another, and I suspect not only the people in the public affairs department that I had worked with as I finished my book, and, well, that story, let's just stop and we'll tell the story. I wanted to go to conference. I'm not a Mormon. I wanted to go to conference. And so I heard from some visiting scholars, an RLDS scholar, scholars that had that were working on Mormon studies that were not Mormon, that, and they had asked to go to conference. And they were all, of course, men. And this is back in the days when, you know, you got into the tabernacle and you looked down from the balcony and it was all black suits and white shirts and all men. Has it changed a lot? I don't know. But I know that in those days it was all men. So I asked to go to conference and they didn't know what to do, because they certainly couldn't put me up there on the front row with those visiting people, because I was not the right gender. And so they put me with the press, upstairs with the press, and that's how I started to get to know the people in the public affairs department, and I have gotten to know those people over the years for this and that and the other reason, but mainly because they liked me and I got along with them fine, and somehow or other we started being friends. When the Hoffman story happened, people would call me up and they'd say, "What do you think about so-and-so?" And I'd say, I'm really busy right now. I'll call you back, or you can call me back in 30 minutes. They'd hang down the phone. I'd pick up the phone. I'd call the public affairs department and I'd say, "What happened?" And then I'd say, "Well, this is what I think about it." No, this is a problem. When they call you up, what do you think about it and you don't even know? I got a call a week and a half ago, "What do you think about what happened at conference and all these, the calling of these new quorums of 70? What do you think about it?" I didn't know they'd call new quorums of 70. So I said, "I'll talk to you after a while." I called up, put on the email, "Please tell me what's going on," so I can tell them what I think about it. Well, at any rate, somehow or other, from point to point to point, my name managed to get into LexisNexis. Does anybody know what LexisNexis is? LexisNexis is what journalists use. Journalists used to do work by getting out and using their feet and going to hunt the story. Now if they're assigned a story, they call it up on LexisNexis, and this is an electronic thing that will call up everything that has been printed about a topic in the last year. And so what happened, I'm convinced, and I'm started to ask people, "How did you decide to call me?" And they will say, "Well, you know, you were quoted in Time, you were quoted in Newsweek, they call me up on LexisNexis," and so somehow or other, my name has gotten up there at the top to, when you have to do a Mormon story, you got to have a non-Mormon talk about the Mormons. And it turns out that I'm the person they call. My husband has started tracking it. I get a call on the average of once a week. Now, that's a lot of calls. I spend a lot of time talking to the press. The questions are all over the map. I can always tell you what people are concerned about because these are what the questions are. Of course, if something happens, I mean, when a president of the church dies and a new president comes in, then they'll call me and I'll know what's going on. When they change the wording in the temple ceremony, they call me. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't go to the temple. I'm not sure. I don't know what is that." "Oh, we know what happened. Just tell us what it means," they said. Incredible numbers of stories recently about two major things, about the missionaries going into Harlem and into areas where there are lots of black people. Stories about temples. Why are they building so many temples? What's going on here? Or stories, I got a whole bunch of calls, not last summer, but summer before, about why are they baptizing all of those people that were killed in the Holocaust? You know, now, just ask yourself. Now, pretend. Let's pretend. You're not a Mormon. You don't know anything about Mormonism. You're a reporter, and you're assigned to do a story on why are they baptizing people that are dead that were killed in the Holocaust. Now, where do you start? I mean, do you start with the Holocaust? Do you start with there was this prophet whose name was Joseph Smith? Where do you start? Well, what I've learned is a way to explain to the press how Mormonism works. In a way that they can make sense of it. And I want to tell you this, what I tell them, and see what you think. You think it's wrong, you think it's right, you think it's whatever. But you must pretend that you know nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Erase everything from your minds and say, this is what Mormonism is. How is it different from being Baptist or being Methodist or being Presbyterian or being Catholic or whatever? Here's the way I go about it. I start with the fact that there was a prophet who was born in the early part of the 19th century, that, and I briefly, very briefly, explain that he found the Book of Mormon. And I very briefly explain what is in the Book of Mormon, that its content is a content that tells about Jesus appearing on this continent, emphasizing more than anything else that this is a Christian document that is an additional scripture. Now, a lot of people say, you know, what do you mean? I said, and then I have to do a little detour and said, what's a scripture? A scripture is what people think is a scripture. The Baptists don't think the Book of Mormon is a scripture, but the Mormons think the Book of Mormon is a scripture, and to them it is scripture. I mean, this is the kind of thing. The Jews don't think that the Quran is a scripture, but the Muslims do, that kind of thing. You know, you have to use you're just sort of starting like A, B, C when you're talking to these people. Well, at any rate, I move from Joseph Smith to the beginnings of Mormonism, and I ask them to think about layers, how things are built in layers. And I begin by saying, and the key to all this is restoration. I say that the Mormons are a restoration people. Now, I've got this all written down, but if you feel comfortable with me talking instead of reading, I hope it's okay. I can just talk because I'm talking to you the way I talk to the press. Okay. They say, what's restoration? And I say, restoration is restoring what was once here before. Okay. And I say that in the beginning, the Mormons believed that the church was restored. This is the restoration of the church. And that this was the New Testament church, that it had apostles, that the people in the New Testament church were called saints, And so these new people understood themselves as Latter-day Saints. And I lay that foundation that Mormonism understood itself in the beginning, first and foremost, as the restoration of the Christian church. Now that then allows me to come back when they, you know, when the question is, well, why did they change the logo? Well, you know, if you put it this way, you can come back to it. You say it was there in the beginning. They're just emphasizing that. Now, that's the bottom layer. The second layer is the restoration of Israel. The whole understanding of the restoration of Israel. So that the church becomes the agent of the restoration of Israel, which includes such things as the gathering, the patriarchy, the patriarchal blessing, the temple, the building of the temple, and the creation of the kingdom, the literal kingdom of God that you have in Nauvoo. You have it first in, well, you have it first in Kirtland, sort of. You have it even more in Independence than at its first full flowering in Nauvoo. And then that third layer is the restoration of all things. Now, it's pretty easy, and I don't lose many students, and I don't lose many reporters, as long as I'm going along and I can talk about being Mormon is belonging to the original church, restored to the earth. Being Mormon is analogous to being Jewish. They follow me right along. And then when I talk about the restoration of all things, then they begin to get a little lost. And that I have to spend a little more time with to talk about marriage for time and eternity, eternal progression, and so on. But I do it in this layered fashion so that I can then tell them that what has happened, and this is what my new book is about, being Mormon, what's happened since the Second World War. What has happened, it seems to me, is that those top two layers have been essentially moved over into the temple. And if you don't go to the temple, it's, and since I don't go to the temple, I really have to work hard at this. But if you don't go to the temple, then understanding the full implications of marriage for time and eternity, what Mike Wallace said, families are forever. How do you mean that? And I sort of say, you didn't do your homework. but that part is tough to explain. But by doing it this way and separating it out from Mormons as an ethnic group, the restoration of Israel, and the importance of the restoration of the church, then their questions can always be turned back this way, that way, and the other way to say, now remember, this is the way I said it. Now, if you notice, the second half of my title is How a Gentile Learned to Explain Mormonism to the Press, and I've tried to tell you that. The second half is that once that happened, and once I got it straight in my head, then I began to see all sorts of fascinating things about Mormon history, about what's happened in the last 50 years and so forth. And I want to just summarize, you know, tease you so you'll have to buy my new book when it comes out, if I ever finish it. But here's what I think. We have not fully understood those people who didn't come to Utah, but in doing the McClellan, the journals of William McClellan that I edited, that came out a couple of years ago, I realized that it's not just what happened at the end of Nauvoo, but the beginning of the church was really emphasizing the restoration of the church. Now, William McClellan, an apostle, wrote this earliest journal that we've ever found of the Mormons, started 1831 to 1836. Again and again and again and again, he emphasizes the restoration of the church. He talks about joining the church. Well, you should go to Zion. You should leave where you are and go and live in independence. Or you should leave where you are and go and live in Kirtland to go with the gathering. But theologically, his emphasis and the emphasis of the early apostles was on the restoration of the church. And that was just astonishing to me to discover that he was at the Kirtland Temple dedication and he does not even mention it in his diaries. He was concerned, and the Kirtland Temple dedication is the symbol of the restoration of Israel. I mean, it's the temple, it's the restoration of Israel. But he was concerned with the restoration of the church. And when they changed the title from the Church of Jesus Christ to the Church of the Latter-day Saints, he thought they were going, it was going down the drain. And I began to see that if you track it back, you can see that those people who converted to Mormonism when it was mainly the restoration of the church, began to feel very uncomfortable, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, when the new revelations talked about the restoration of Israel. So they were converted to Mormonism as it was when they heard the message the first time. And unless they were living close to the prophet, they found it very difficult to accept the implications of the new revelation. And then, of course, when you move from the restoration of the church and the restoration of Israel to the restoration of all things, which includes plural marriage, then that's really tough to take. And so you begin to understand that many of those people that were called apostates simply were converted to a Mormonism that changed as they lived through it. And unless they were right there where the prophet was, and unless they were centrally involved, then it was tough to accept the new things that were going on. Last point. Now that I am looking at what has happened to Mormonism in the last 50 years, I begin to see that the growth of the church has made the understanding of Mormonism as a chosen people, as an ethnic group, much less fully experienced. It's almost attenuated. When there are more Mormons outside the United States than inside the United States, when Mormons are living all over the country and not just in the Intermountain West, the feel of being, of living with the folk, with the people, is being attenuated. Therefore, what happened in the early days is being, in a sense, reversed. This is what Armand is talking about in his book. Armand Moss is talking about in his book. This is what we begin to see, this struggle with the way Mormonism seems to live inside a religion that is built on the notion of continuing revelation. Okay, I'll stop for there, and we'll talk after Val talks, then we can ask questions.
Val is known throughout Mormondom as the co-author of the groundbreaking, award-winning biography of Emma Smith. Originally published by Doubleday as Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith, Prophet's Wife, Elect Lady, Polygamy's Foe. Now in its post-Hoffman second edition, published by the University of Illinois Press, and with its shortened title, Mormon Enigma, Emma Hale Smith. She is presently Associate Professor of History at Northern Arizona University and the author of a forthcoming biography, David Smith. Her presentation tonight is Renegades from Brighamism, The Prophet's Sons and Utah Mormonism, 1865 through 1875.
I don't know about this. Can you hear me? Should I take my heels off? Should I hold it like a rock singer? You can hear me? Good, good, good. What I really want to do tonight is to extend an invitation to you to give me a little feedback about whether I might be on to another project. And this is the first time I've ever spoken in public about what I'm thinking of doing next. And so I'm interested in your reaction and what you think about whether I ought to proceed with this, whether maybe it's an article or maybe it's a book or maybe there's something to it or not. But one thing that happened to me in the course of writing two biographies, first of Emma Smith, who, after her son, Joseph III, became the president of the Reorganized Church, associated herself with that church, and then wrote a biography of her son and Joseph II's son, David, who as a young man joined his brother's church and then was sent by Joseph III to be a missionary among the Mormons in Utah. In other words, David showed up in Utah to steal sheep from Brigham and to see if he could convert Mormons in Utah to the reorganized point of view. While I researched those books and while I was trying to get them written, there was a constant tempting detour that has been consistently the question that I have had to pull myself back and not write into the biographies, because it's such a temptation always to start a biography on someone, to start a biography of Emma and end up writing a biography of Joseph, to start a biography of David and end up writing a biography of his elder brother, Joseph III, who was more powerful, and so forth. And so I've always had to pull myself back, okay? Well, that detour has consistently been the question, to what extent did the LDS and our LDS churches influence each other over the years, and what has been the nature of their relationship? And so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that tonight, and I want to clarify some of the terminology I use. I was trying to explain to Albert in the car on the way down what this project was, and realized that I have to say very carefully to you, and I will try to remember to do this, Joseph the Third, because I have lived with this family for so long, almost 20 years now. I know Emma and her sons better than I know my own uncles and aunts, I think. And so when I talk about Joseph, I'm most of the time talking about Joseph the Third. So I will try to remember to say that when I talk to you tonight and keep that up. But if things seem a little puzzling, just remember the terminology. And so I'm going to proceed here, and I'm going to talk and read a little bit at the same time. But to set the stage, by 1860, when the account that I want to deal with begins, the Mormons had been in Utah 13 years. Brigham Young was 59. The prophet, Joseph Smith II, had been dead 16 years. Emma Smith Biedemann, his wife, since remarried, was 56. Her son, Joseph Smith III, was 28, and his brothers were Frederick, 24, and soon to die in 1862. Alexander 22 and David 16. And in 1860, young Joseph Smith III upset the Mormon apple cart when he went to Plano, Illinois, to be named president of the reorganized church in April. And his first public statement denounced polygamy. And from that beginning then, the interaction between these two churches has occupied some time and attention on my part. And as soon as the reorganized church was begun, each church, that is the Western Church in Utah and the reorganized church in the Midwest, became exceedingly uncomfortable with the presence of the other. And to a lesser or greater extent, each tried to influence and to mold the other to a better fit. And in doing so, each church had three main tools. And like any other tool we use, some of them were very effective and some of them were not so effective. Some of them were pretty blunt. some of them were very incisive. But those tools were differing interpretations of the same scriptures and the same history. Reliance on witnesses. Notoriously a difficult issue, because witnesses see things from a different way. And number three, the leadership of their presidents. And so as I talk to you tonight, you will see how some of those things come into play. And to varying degrees and to of success and to varying degrees of sophistication, I want to give you a very first look at the interaction between the LDS and the RLDS church leaders. The most urgent, and I will present this mostly from the RLDS point of view. I want to say that up front, ahead of time. I find myself, of course, as a traditional Western Mormon, having turned myself 180 degrees so that I can present this from another point of view. And so you will hear that, I think, as I speak. Without any more further explanation, I'm going to go on. The most urgent concern in the RLDS church throughout the 1860s was membership. And without sufficient numbers to support the church with donations of time and money, the establishment of the reorganization as a valid Mormon gospel. And I do want to say that early on, Joseph III wanted very much to assume the name Mormon. He was not happy that that his father's church had been taken over by, that the name Mormon was associated with the Western Church. Steadily, a few Midwestern converts came in, but the dramatic increase in size that Joseph III might have expected, compared to the phenomenal growth of Nauvoo in the early years, simply did not happen. And it wasn't long before Joseph III eyed a more fruitful ground in the West. And no plum looked riper for the plucking than the Mormons, who had known and who had supported his father and who had followed Brigham Young. And it seemed reasonable to Joseph Smith III in the mid and the late 1860s that a welcome reception awaited him and his church, because Western Mormons had already accepted basic Mormon beliefs and fundamentals of the new gospel, because frequent visitors to the Midwest from Utah inevitably reacted with warmth and respect to the sons of Joseph, because lurid press accounts ridiculed the Mormon practice of polygamy and hinted that perhaps Brigham Young's hold on the church was loosening enough to allow other ideas to prevail in Utah, and because the theocracy of the early years had been substantially replaced by federal territorial appointees. So in other words, it seemed to Joseph a propitious time in 1863 for a serious campaign in Utah. He was wrong. The Morazite Rebellion against Brigham Young and the Mormon hegemony in Utah had just ended in violence and tragedy. The Utah Reformation of 1857 had given rise to an intense emotional spiritualism and had spun Joseph Morris off to establish his own church with himself as prophet. And confrontations between the Morrisites and the Mormons escalated into war in 1862, resulting in Morris's murder on June 18th and the scattering and disbursement of his followers, one of whom, the talented Mark A. Forskett, if I have any RLDS people in this audience, that will be a most familiar name to them. Mark A. Forskett soon joined the reorganization in the Midwest. And the mood in Utah in 1863 was not friendly toward offshoots of the Mormon movement and the men who led them. And before tapping either of his brothers for this most important military assignment, Joseph III sent Edmund C. Briggs and Alexander McCord to Utah. Now, this may have been the first mistake if you're talking about trying to find some kind of rapprochement between the LDS and RLDS churches. And I think having studied this for some 21 years now, the one thing I can say to you is that the saddest thing I know in Mormon history is that the churches are split. That the families, that the Smith family ought to be together, This is in my mind an unnecessary split. So I'm trying to figure out, you see how it happened. First mistake on the part of Joseph III. Instead of coming himself, he sent two very avid RLDS missionaries to Utah. And they met with Brigham Young and some 25 or 30 Utah church leaders in an assembly that soon became decidedly antagonistic. The situation was very difficult for Brigham Young because he had refrained from poisoning the attitude of the people in Utah toward the sons of Joseph Smith. And now that those same sons governed a rival faction of the old Mormon church, some of the membership in Utah reacted favorably toward them. Attempting to defuse Joseph Smith III's influence, Orson Hyde told a group in eastern Utah that the Joseph Smith who was president of the reorganized church was not the son of the prophet Joseph Smith of Nauvoo. While Orson Hyde probably meant, I'm giving him all the benefit of the doubt here, okay, that Joseph III broke with his father's tradition, his words could also have had a more literal interpretation among the Utah newcomers, for whom the Nauvoo experience seemed remote. I mean, Utah is full of people now who have immigrated directly to Utah. They haven't got the Nauvoo, Kirtland, Missouri experience behind them. So how do they know what the situation is with the Sons of Joseph as they're leading a rival church? In the 1863 meeting in Salt Lake City, Brigham Young warned Briggs and McCord that no private home or meeting house in Utah would welcome missionaries from the reorganization and that he could not guarantee their safety. And according to Briggs, Young blamed Emma Smith for the establishment of the reorganized church and said so in graphic terms, quote, "Emma Biderman is a wicked, wicked, wicked woman and always was. Joseph III is led by his mother and is now acting under the direction of Emma, and I know more of Emma, Joseph, Alexander, and David than they know of themselves," she fulminated. Brigham's statement was an exaggeration. I want to talk about the relationship with Emma in just a minute. I'll get to that. Brigham's statement was an exaggeration. He had not seen the Smith boys since 1847 when they were children of 14, 11, 9, and 3. He referred to the association he had had with their father and the expectations he held for their future, which to him, in their obvious obstinacy, they were not fulfilling. And his assertions quickly gained canonical status among the brethren. Quote, "The matter of Josephism rests upon the brethren," commented Jesse N. Smith to the Parowan School of Prophets. He too found someone whom he could blame for young Joseph's perfidy without anyone in the company objecting. Quote, "Emma was ambitious and sought the power to lead the people. Brigham told her a woman could not lead the people." And then in an incredible story, Jesse Smith likened Emma to the Mexican-American folktale of La Llorona, the woman who raised her children all their lives to get revenge for an injustice done to her. And he refers to Emma in those terms. Unable to believe the Sons of Joseph would oppose the Utah church without having fallen under some unholy influence, the Mormon leadership blamed Emma Smith for her son's work with the RLDS church. Quote, "So it was with Emma. She dwarfed the minds of her children until they were not the men that they should be." Notwithstanding the charges and the hostility, Briggs and McCord carried a three-pronged message to the Utah Mormons. First, that Joseph Smith III of Plano, Illinois, was the true leader of the entire Mormon church by virtue of his birthright. Second, that Brigham Young had usurped his position and was not the designated successor. And third, that the practice of plural marriage was an abomination that Brigham Young had introduced to the church, which had never been promulgated and yet alone practiced by Joseph Smith. Their message was not calculated to endear themselves to President Young, but they did win a few converts, most of whom immediately left Utah for California or returned to the Midwest. And though Briggs and McCord tried to build up RLDS leadership in Utah, they were largely unsuccessful. 3 years after the Briggs and McCord missionary trip, Joseph assigned his brother, Alexander Hale Smith, to take charge of the California mission in 1866. And thus, Joseph III reintroduced his own family to the controversies of Mormonism. Alexander 28 was a farmer in Nauvoo with a reputation as a skilled hunter and marksman. He was, for those of you who are hunters in the West, he was so good a shot that the marksmanship contest in Nauvoo inevitably ended with all comers, that the shout would go out, all comers, welcome to the contest except Alexander Smith. Because he shot so well that he always won. Of a stocky athletic build, he was slow to anger, and he reacted for the most part with reason and calmness to the vicissitudes of life, except, as he would soon discover, to the charged emotional climate surrounding his father's reputation. The Western Mormons would test his equanimity and find it lacking. And now we have a wonderful account that is in Alex's journal. He and his companions showed up at Fort Laramie, and they were ready to make this last major push, this last major leg west to Salt Lake. And they felt they had not been traveling with Mormon wagon trains before, but at Fort Laramie they fell into a Mormon wagon train, and so they travel along trying not to say who they were. Trying to be very quiet. And so here you have three Josephite missionaries, strongly antagonistic to the Utah Church, travel quietly in the midst of several hundred devout Mormons immigrating to Utah. Alexander noticed he was the object of some attention, and shortly after getting underway, one of the immigrants approached Alex to learn his name in order to give it to wagon master Thomas Ricks. Sensing a ruse, Alex said his name was Alexander Hale, which of course it was, and omitted the Smith. And within a few days, Captain Ricks rode his horse alongside Alex. "Where did you say you hailed from?" the captain asked. "I come from the state of Illinois." "What part of the state?" "Western part." "What county or town, may I ask?" "Certainly, sir. I come from Nauvoo, Hancock County." "Ah, I thought so," said Ricks, and looked Alex straight in the eye, and Alex confided to his journal, "We understood each other." Alexander and his companions traveled west without undue incident under Rick's watchful eye, and they entered Salt Lake City late in August and were greeted by John Smith, patriarch in the Utah Church. And the newspapers announced that Alex was not in town to convert the Mormons in Utah, but that he was on his way to California. And he preached a couple of sermons in Utah, found himself opposed by Joseph F. Smith. It was difficult to face down a cousin. Remained in Salt Lake only 15 days and then continued on his way to California. And no mention is made in his journal of whether he actually met or was introduced to Brigham Young, but undoubtedly Brigham Young kept an eye on Alex and knew he was there and followed his speaking and his talking. And at some point, there must have been a very bitter exchange of some kind that went on, because when David entered Utah for the first time, he was called upon to defend some of Alexander's cutting remarks. And so the second attempt then for Joseph III to influence the church in Utah had not been a smash success. By springtime, 1869, all right, 1863 is the first, 1866, Alex is there, 1869. Joseph III had again firmed up his plans for further westward expansion of the church. He determined to see once again if disillusionment in Utah opened those doors to enough to welcome the reorganization, and so we called Alexander and David together to missionary service in Utah and California. Joseph well understood that to send two sons of the Mormon prophet directed the reorganization's heavy artillery toward Utah. The prospect was both irresistible and ill-advised. David was 24. Alex won when they took their leave for Utah. David must have been fairly bursting with anticipation at the excitement ahead. And remember, I just wrote a biography of that very interesting young man. Utah, with the Mormons and the mythic Brigham Young, had always menaced his future. In the spring of 1862, when David was only 17 years old, he wrote a poem in a little journal called Farewell to Nauvoo. "I am going to leave you," he said to his hometown. "Oh, sad is thy story, beloved Nauvoo, and Brigham has come, how I hate his dread power. The salt land for my home will not do." And so he's not, what I'm saying is he's not approaching Utah with the most conciliatory attitude toward Utah and its leadership. By 1869, Brigham Young had focused formidable energy and organization skills for 22 years to establish the Mormons in a location where they could live their religion in peace. The exodus across the plains had been enormously successful by all counts. Salt Lake City and about 350 other settlements were scattered throughout the American West. And in the process, Brigham Young had learned to give orders to and expect them to be followed. With equal confidence, he advised his people when to plant the crops and when to marry. He believed in the utopian ideal that the wishes of individuals needed to be subsumed to the good of the whole, and thus without a second thought, he sent men and women who had plowed and built and created homesteads in newly established towns off to a new settlement to do the same all over again. Throughout his lifetime, he revered his prophet Joseph Smith, Jr., and he saw to it that his people did as well. It was unthinkable to Brigham Young that Joseph's sons would not see the church as Joseph's church and someday join him. And he could not imagine that the sons of the man whom he so loved would prove to be his most serious competition. And incidentally, without turning this into a psychological history, which I am not qualified to do, Joseph Smith III and Brigham Young shared strikingly similar personality characteristics. They had a wry sense of humor that enabled them to deal with the trivialities of their followers and at the same time as they urged them on to greater sacrifice. Joseph III and Brigham seldom retracted a statement or changed their convictions, and both had absolute confidence that their opinions were correct. And David and Alexander's mission faced overwhelming obstacles almost before it began, but had they, when dealing with Brigham, used the diplomatic skills which had enabled them to work with their own brother, who was their prophet and president, they might have had a less trying time. Had David and Alexander approached Utah with less apprehension, they could have found some humor and irony in the similarities of the two Mormon church presidents. But as it was, they focused so intently on their goal of converting the Utah Mormons that they were blind to the means of achieving it. And in other ways, ignorance was also bliss. David and Alexander Smith steadily advanced toward Utah when the conditions for proselytizing in the formidable Mormon culture were worse than in 1863 and in 1866. The railroads, which had seen such an economic and technological boon to the rest of the country, threatened Mormon economy and hegemony. After 22 years of isolation, reinforced by geography and the nation's absorption with the Civil War, Brigham Young and his followers knew that the railroad was going to spew unknown numbers of non-Mormons among them. Of what stripe, of what character, of what economy, of what predilection could only be guessed. Utah sat like a magnet between Omaha and San Francisco. Aggressive, westward-thrusting Americans were unlikely to heed the Mormon Church's desire that they deliver their trade goods to the Mormon merchants and then move on. And of the passengers converging on Utah, David and Alexander should have been the most worrisome to Mormons uneasy about changes on the horizon. And while the intercontinental train steadily traversed Utah, trouble brewed from within. With memories of the Morrisite violence still bright, a new challenge rose in its place. Brigham Young had long fought to limit the power and profits of the merchants in the territory, and he finally resorted to ordering a boycott of non-Mormon businesses. And at the same time, he kept the pressure on his own merchants to reduce their, quote, unconscionably, unquote, high profits. While the Smith sons traveled west, Mormon and ex-Mormons, Mormon merchants such as William S. Godbey, Henry W. Lawrence, the Walker brothers, schemed to challenge Brigham's authority in secular matters, a move which is tantamount to challenging his ecclesiastical power as well, since the Mormons made little or no distinction between the two. Godbey, Elias Harrison, William Sherman, Edward Tullidge threw down the gauntlet when they debuted the Utah magazine in opposition to the Saint Deseret News during the summer of 1869. Now, these two boys are on their way to Utah to preach reorganized Mormonism at the same time as all of these changes are coming into the Salt Lake Valley. Two most unlikely bedfellows, merchants and intellectuals, joined forces against Brigham Young. Well-funded and well-known, these men were about to issue the strongest public challenge to Mormon leadership yet, called the New Movement by its proponents, and because of Godbey's stature in the community, it became the Godbeite rebellion of its detractors. Joseph Morris's followers were easily dismissed as a fringe group, but not so the Godbeites. Their leadership represented a wide-strain, mainstream Mormon intellectual and financial interest. And these men understood power and were jealous of church authority. And David and Alex travel steadily toward a society whose own insurrection, the new movement slash Godbeites, would both co-opt and overshadow their message. David and Alex arrived in Salt Lake City on July 15, 1869. They drifted through the city as it lay in the July sun, with the waters of City Creek tumbling down the flume and the grass and the trees bespeaking the dedication that had made them grow on what had been a barren land. The Mormons had entered the Broad Valley in the same July heat only 20 years earlier and built a city which now was 3 years younger than David. And with perfect equanimity, David and Alex expected to change its vision. Hearing that Brigham Young occasionally made the tabernacle available for use by other religions, they arranged an interview to request its use. And there's a wonderful account in these men's journals about that wait. They went to the church offices in Salt Lake, and they were kept waiting for almost 2.5 hours. And then they finally left in a huff, feeling that, you know, very insulted and put upon when they were finally invited in. And when they were invited in, what had happened is that their wait had given time for the word to go all through the city. Joseph's boys are here. Joseph's boys are here. And they walked into a room filled with some 20 or 25 Mormon church leaders, John Taylor, Daniel Wells, George A. Smith, Joseph F. Smith, all the old Nauvoo Mormons now in Salt Lake hustled to the meeting with Joseph's boys. David's arrival in Utah had long been anticipated by some among them, and in the feud between the appointed officials of Utah Territory, okay, now these are the appointed secular officials, and the Mormon church leaders over the issue of polygamy, David's name had come up in 1866. Unable to wean the Mormon people from polygamy through legislation, federal government appointees sought other means to weaken the church influence. Early in 1866, Joseph F. Smith wrote jeeringly to Samuel H. B. Smith that one of the army officers had gone to Washington, D.C., quote, to favor, if possible, the plan of getting Cousin David out here with a view to break down the power and influence of President Young and in that way abolish polygamy. Phew! What a coup d'etat! Don't we Mormons quake! And so, in spite of Joseph Smith's ridicule, some Mormons did expect David to assume a leading role in Utah Mormonism. The reorganization looking for a leader wrote about Utah in 1866 in his journal, quote, this year, nothing of grave importance took place, only that the church had despaired of Joseph the son of the seer doing anything for God or for the church, as he had connected himself with these apostates and had become their seer and revelator. But our hopes was David, the child of promise, would eventually see the error of his ways and yet come to the church. And now, in this meeting, the Mormons assembled to see for the first time the child of promise as an adult. And I might remind, I've got a fly up here that's not going to let me talk here. If you remember now that that David was born 5 months after Joseph the prophet, Joseph the second, was killed. And so this child of promise now has had a mythical place in Mormon thought for some time. The room in which they gathered was nicely furnished and hung with portraits, chief among them that of Joseph Smith. David noticed the irony of asking for a favor under such remarkable circumstances. Two of the prophet's sons sat in the room with people who believed they had strayed from the truth and negotiated for preaching space under the likeness of their own father. And so after the introductions, Alexander stated that he and David were aware that other churches used the tabernacle on occasions, and he requested that they be allowed to preach the message of the reorganization there. Alex probably gauged Brigham's animosity to be lower than it was, for the church leader still smarted from Alex's last visit. Brushing aside the request, Brigham Young asked Alex, could be an emissary from... Oh, I got him. As my mother always said, you know, flies take off backwards, honey. You have to hit them from behind. Okay. So here we have then this group of 25 or 30 Mormon people, Mormon leaders, who have been 22 years away from Nauvoo. And the sons of Joseph have come, but they have come to preach the wrong gospel for the wrong church. And so we have now an assembly, a meeting, and I have put this scene together from many different sources, and I have cut it extensively for this presentation. It runs almost 30 pages in my when I write it up completely. Brushing aside the request for the tabernacle, Brigham Young asked Alexander to retract some of the unflattering statements he had made in public meetings 3 years earlier. And when Alexander stubbornly refused to do so, Brigham asked him, "Where did you get your information?" Or rather, misinformation. "And from your mother?" And Alex said, "Yes, sir, and I have confidence in her word." And unfortunately, this answer so angered Brigham Young that he launched into a tirade against Emma Smith. And at this point, if the conversation was reported correctly, and I only have, you see, second-hand accounts here, both Alexander Smith and Brigham Young used Emma's accounts of Joseph's life for their own purposes, neither knowing the full story. By her son's own admission, Emma had told them virtually nothing about the plural marriages existing in her own home in Nauvoo. And Brigham, too, erred in his evaluation of Emma, for he thought Emma had turned her sons against them. And I believe, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this, that Brigham Young's faith in the power inherent in Joseph Smith II's blessing that his son Joseph III would succeed him as president was so strong that Brigham believed only Emma could have undone the prophet's wish. And so we have here now a very interesting thing that occurs, and this is once again, I have about 3 minutes here, and I'm going to stop. Elbert will be okay. Thank you. Okay, so now, in Victorian America, motherhood was sacred. And so from Alex and David's point of view, during this interaction with Brigham Young, where they feel their mother has been insulted and falsely accused, and Brigham will go on to accuse her of poisoning their father, attempting to poison their father. And that was a puzzle for us when we were writing the Mormon Enigma book, and it took a call to my physician to say, if this were a diagnosis that were brought into your office today, what would you say? And he said, unquestionably, that man has a bleeding ulcer. And so when he vomited after he ate food in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith had not been poisoned by Emma. He was eating rich, gravy food and vomiting it afterwards, but nobody understood why, and so he was blaming Emma for putting poison in his food since she prepared his meals. So Brigham Young repeats this to the sons. And on the other hand, all right, we have begun as a nation by 1869. Godey's Ladies' Book is the most highly popular women's publication we have ever had. Some 170,000 subscriptions to Godey's Ladies' Book are active in 1870. And she has institutionalized motherhood as a high and holy calling. And so when Emma's character was assaulted by Brigham Young, then the sons reacted in a way. And I think these early meetings resulted in such hard feelings between Brigham Young and the sons of Joseph that the chance of healing, that the chance of getting the churches together when polygamy was no longer an issue, the chance of being able to talk over some of the things later, simply could not happen. Thus in Utah, David and Alexander Smith faced Brigham Young over an issue none of them really understood, but to which each had a dogmatic answer. Alexander and Brigham's conversation grew more heated. Brigham accused Emma of stealing the family portraits and Joseph's ring, all of which Emma undoubtedly had a widow's right to possess. And then in front of her two lovers, Brigham called her, quote, "a liar, the damnedest liar that ever lived," unquote. David immediately defended his mother. "You may as well try to rub silver off the moon as to attempt to destroy the purity of my mother's character." Alexander Smith ordered Brigham Young to stop speaking. He told Young he had gone far enough. His accusations against Emma were false, and he knew it. David responded with some heat, "We will not deny that you have traveled far, suffered much, and labored hard to build up a name for our father. But what sort of a name is it? A name that we, his sons, are ashamed to meet in good society. And it shall be our life's work to remove from our father's name the stain you have heaped upon it." And, of course, he's referring to polygamy. When the men in the room were unanimous in their decision not to let them speak in the Mormons' most famous building, Brigham Young turned to the youngest brother. "No, David, we do not think it best to let you have the tabernacle." And the exchange of opinions in the crowded room illuminated the respective positions of the two Mormon institutions with a sad clarity. The Utahns had paid a heart-rending price for their church. One could imagine nothing more jarring than to have the sons of the very prophet whom they revered accuse them of shaming him. To so completely misunderstand the very purpose and genius behind their hard-won Western kingdom. They knew with certainty that Joseph Smith had introduced plural marriage, for he himself had instructed most of them to take additional wives. David and Alexander, on the other hand, rose up to defend and to reinstate their father's reputation as a prophet in their eyes, a man who had not broken the traditional Christian laws of fidelity and chastity. And the confrontation saddened Brigham, for he had always hoped the sons of Joseph would someday be a part of his church. As David and Alexander prepared to leave the room, he said, "Boys, I would gladly take you to my bosom if I did not think it would be taking a viper to my bosom that would sting me to death." And so, as then David and Alex found other ways to preach in Utah, the Walker brothers arranged for Independence Hall to be available to them, and they converted many people in Utah, went north to Malad and so forth, and then traveled on to California. While here in California, particularly around the San Bernardino area, David had a very serious breakdown, probably the very first of the series of mental instabilities that would leave him in the Illinois State Asylum for the insane within about 6 years of this, 7 years of this time. And so what I want you to give me today, all right, as we get into the question and answer period, is this something that ought to be done? Should we look at the relationship between these two churches to see where the problems were? There's a much larger picture here than just Mormonism. By the time the RLDS people begin to preach and teach among the Utah Mormons, they have traveled extensively through the Midwest. They have debated Methodists. Jan will stand here and defend the Methodists. They've debated Methodists and Baptists and Congregationalists in frontier situations, and they have become very sophisticated at knowing what are the basic arguments of religious enterprise. And so, thank you very much. That's what I'm working on next.
Albert, how much time do we have for questions? Is Albert here? Oh, he's out. Well, let's say 15, 20 minutes. Is that plenty? Albert, 15 minutes or so? Okay. Okay, good. Perhaps it would be best to facilitate the questions if Val and Jan would come up here and linger by the mic. Try to keep your... Okay. Come on up. I'm going to go let him know that you said he can take
it. Yeah. Okay. I want to ask Val the first question. Because it seems to me that we are really doing something that is very... I'm talking about the difference in the LDS and the RLDS church in a way as well. Because it seems to me that what you have here is the RLDS never accepting the restoration of all things. They were happy with the restoration of the church and the restoration of Israel, But when the restoration moved into the restoration of all things, which included plural marriage and eternal progression toward godhood and so forth, that was not the Mormonism they knew. Now, in a sense, I think that the history of Christianity tells us that people can solve theological problems just by using logic and reason and the brain and working things through and redefining terms and so forth.
And finally killing him with the Crusades.
And finally killing them with the Crusades. But nevertheless, it seems to me that there have been a lot of working things through theologically. What I hear Val saying is that this was something that went beyond theological belief. And I'd like to hear her talk about that a bit.
Jan's right. The puzzle of the two churches, if you want to call it now, we look at it in 1997 and we say, oh yeah, you know, I've been to churches, two main Mormon churches, I'm aware there are many others, but I'm talking about these two. I've been to churches now for a long time, no sense, no question that they are different. At that point in 1860, when Joseph Smith, at the age of 28, accepted the position of leader of the reorganized church, what were the differences between the two churches? Okay, and who taught Joseph III what kind of church he was going to lead? He was 14 when his father was killed. He remembered Nauvoo pretty well, and so forth. And so what I see is that there was a time when they were very close. Now then, by definition, people chose to come to Utah from 1846 to, let's say, 1875 or 1880, based on their attitudes toward the validity of the polygamy experience, whether that was indeed a commandment and a revelation or whether it was not. And a lot of them stayed behind who didn't want to go to Utah and continue that. We don't talk a lot about, in our Western history here, about the numbers of wagon trains who went east from Utah back and who tried living in the American West and who found it very uncomfortable and who could not stay. And so I think that the wedge that made it impossible. Okay, so you have that similarity that starts early on. A differing issue over polygamy. But in 1890, after the Woodruff Manifesto came out, what happens then? There's no poster child up there to throw darts at anymore. Polygamy is gone. And that there could have been a rapprochement there at some point. The other thing I want to say, Jan, that your comment about the layering of the churches and how difficult it is when you add a new layer of revelation to them. A wonderful example going on right now in the RLDS church when the revelation came down that the women were to receive the priesthood, number one, and that the RLDS church would build a temple, number two.
And the church is splitting.
And the church is splitting over that. There are huge divisions that have come out of church over that. Many groups and many people who have formed another group and who have said the same thing that people said in various ways. Aha, now the church is in apostasy. Right? Now this new revelation has gone beyond the pale and is more than we can accept. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but it's a bit complicated. I'm starting. Yeah. Jan, you take one, then I'll take one.
Okay. Yeah. I'll just call on you, and you tell us the question, and we'll...
Okay. About 20 years ago, I remember Robert Matthews making a lot of noise about the fact that the RLDS Church was going to start cooperating more. In fact, that was the time in which they made something where the inspired version was added to our scriptures, the portions of it. And then all of a sudden it died. He was preaching the fact that there was going to be a lot of cooperation going on, and then it never happened. Do you know what's going on there?
I will say this, that it is a very good question, and it is, what happened? Was there a point where it looked as if there would be a rapprochement between the two churches? I think the time is in the early 70s. I think what happened, at least my reading of what happened, and I was sort of there, is that when the church, and by that, I mean, Val is talking about the church, and she says the RLDS church. When I say the church, I'm thinking of the LDS church. When the LDS church opened its archives, and there started to be a writing of the history, and there was a rapprochement among the historians of the LDS church and the RLDS church, lots of people who saw this as a wonderful thing thought it would extend into an institutional rapprochement. I think that was probably a part of a period that was when everybody thought that the golden age was right around the corner. If you go back, you think about the 60s, the 70s, but the people joining the church, everything seemed so wonderful. There would never be any problems anymore, and it was all going to work out. I think it was just a part of a time and an atmosphere, and that there was not anything to it much at all, and certainly not on the part of the LDS leaders. And except for maybe one or two people that were not at the very top of the RLDS church, I didn't see it then.
Stay beside me here, Jan. I need some help a little bit with this, but I'm going to push it back 20 years earlier than Jan's answer. And, of course,
I didn't know anything about the Mormons then.
Well, neither did I. Okay, and that is there was real concern in the early 1950s. Can someone here tell me the year? And I'm sorry, I can't remember the year that David O. McKay was made the prophet. What year did David O. McKay assume? 51. Okay, so I'm right. Very early 50s. The president and prophet of the RLDS Church was invited and came to David O. McKay's ordination as president, as an honored guest, there was a significant action, and you need to go back and look in Norma Derry Hiles' biography of, I think it's Israel Smith, where she recounts that event where at the time that David O. McKay was put in as prophet, either all the people in the room stood or all of the people in the room raised a hand, and Israel did so as well, out of respect and appreciation. But he went home to the Midwest to Firestorm after that, a sense that he had given allegiance away. And so the problem, you know, happens is that people are very concerned that their leaders are not representing them exactly right, and a feeling of brotherhood and so forth, having that be understood that way, that turned it into a brouhaha again. So there have been a couple of times when that might have happened. One question here.
I see it in a slightly different way. Centrist, yes, in its in the way the LDS Church is cooperating with other churches, including the RLDS Church, on social issues, on dealing with human crisis, with human need, and so forth. But I see what's happening in the LDS Church in a different way. I think that and that's why I said that my layering helps me a lot, because I think that if you look at the restoration of all things, that is almost entirely turned into symbol, with the exception of the notion of the family, and that's of course not in. I mean, everybody among the Latter-day Saints sort of talks to me is as if the Latter-day Saints had a patent on, you know, the importance of the family. When you find it in the evangelical church, you find exactly the same thing in the evangelical church. I mean, they have the same social and familial agenda. But what happens in the temple is so symbolic that it preserves that restoration of all things, but it's not public anymore. And so in that sense, it's more centrist. And the attenuation of the notion of Mormons as an ethnic group and so forth, it seems to me that it brings the Mormons more in, you know, pretty much once you have the block meeting plan, you guys go to churches like I do. And when I was so... I was so amazed when Mike Wallace had this big deal about the Mormons go to church for 3 hours on Sunday morning, and I mean 3 hours on Sunday, and he thought that was a big deal. And I know people that go to church for 4.5 hours. You know, I mean, it just depends. So I don't think it's centrist theologically, but I think that the RLDS Church is moving in a more centrist theological direction.
Discuss the layering that carries the credibility.
I hope, I must say that I am publishing this in a variety of ways, and maybe Albert will publish it in Sunstone as well. But it will appear first in a, there's a new book on the makers of American theology, and I was asked to do Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. And I developed this layering and worked it out in the article length that I have. It will be there. It will be in an article that's in a forthcoming book from Illinois on religious minorities in the American Protestant mainstream. It is at the heart of my... I've just done the new entry on Mormonism in the Americana. Now, I've put it out there. You guys are welcome to it, and you can always say, as Jan Shipp says, it always makes me happy. I don't know whether, I mean, here's what I think. I mean, I guess here's what I think. I think it was easier for me to see from the outside than you to see from the inside, putting it in that fashion. But once I've said it and you say, yeah, that's Mormon doctrine, welcome to it. I know that, but for the most part, and I know that there are very skilled people in the public affairs and very skilled reporters and that sort of thing, but I don't think what the Latter-day Saints have done that I have done now is to draw the parallels that make it clear. It's not comparative religion, but just simply to say ethnic group like the Jews, instead of just saying chosen people. I mean, chosen people is like a claim, and everybody's saying, oh well, you know, those people, they think they're special, and everybody, you know, I guess it is because I had to teach religious studies that I learned to draw those parallels. Yeah. But use them. I know what you're saying. You are using traditional Christian theology to explain to others, and especially I will point to the problem of what Mormons mean by the atonement and what other people mean by the atonement. That is the most radical difference. And so people, you know, but of course it's going to influence LDS theology. You are a religious group that accepts continuing revelation. It will eventually work its way through in a variety of ways. But that's the way religion works. And so I think you're in a particular tricky time right now with using the language of traditional Christianity. Excuse me, there's a question back here. I ask it this way. I mean, if you looked very closely at the third chapter of my book, and a lot of people understood what I was trying to say, but a lot of people missed it. And when I said a new religious tradition, they said, "Oh, she's trying to say that we're not Christian," that sort of thing. I was very careful to point out that when Christianity came into existence, it began as a movement whose members thought they had found the best way to be Jews. But by the second century, they had come to realize that there was something more than just being Jewish that was going on there. And I am convinced that the Mormons, and especially after I worked with the McClellan stuff, there's no doubt in my mind that the early Mormons thought they had found the best way to be Christian. But there is also no doubt in my mind that in the restoration of Israel and the restoration of all things, the Mormons are different from traditional Christianity, by which I mean Protestants and Catholics. Does that help? I get called down all the time when I say, I wrote that article, "Are Mormons Christian?" And I said in the final analysis that there is nobody on this earth that can say this group is Christian and that group is not. And I compared it to the Supreme Court and said there's no Supreme Court that can settle that. We have to leave it to a higher court. Question over here.
Thank you very much. I needed that. It has been a bit of a lonely issue. I think I am the only traditional Western Mormon historian who has spent that much time looking at the RLDS experience, and I don't pretend to understand it, but it has been fascinating to look at that. Thank you.
Well, I see that too. I mean, I see the extreme desire to be pulled toward the center, but I also see the emphasis on the temple. And you can pull toward the center all you want to. As long as you drag the temple behind, you're never going to get there. Theologically, the notion of the restoration of all things that carries with it the understanding that this carries itself back to the to restoring what was in the beginning is simply not what is in the center of Catholic and Protestant theology in any way. And after all, this is the way I tell my students, when I had students, I'm no longer teaching, but in Protestant theology, And in Catholic theology, life is pass-fail. You go to hell or you go to heaven, and that's it. And there's nothing else there. The notion of eternal membership in a family, the notion of eternal progression, is just not a part of traditional Christianity. And that I see as centered in the temple. Now maybe, I haven't been through the temple. So maybe that's not what happens in the temple. But it seems to me that that means that. And as long as you hold on to and go further with the emphasis on the Book of Mormon, you're not moving to the center. That kind of thing. Even though the ethnic feel is attenuated very much. Yeah. And me too.
Thank you so much. And speaking of Mr. Sunstone, Albert has a few announcements for us.